Reset your system clock to 1991, strap on your red toucan sunglasses, and join us on today's multimedia hyperguide tour of Windows 3.1. Again, folks, I'm your host, SuperVGA, and I will be talking about the Microsoft Entertainment Pack Endless Skier Ski Free in today's episode. Good morning again, my neglected audience. It's your friend, SuperVGA. I missed you very much. Remember that promise I made about releasing monthly shows? Maybe I need to stop making those kinds of promises and just kind of get on with making the shows. So let's talk DOS and Windows gaming memories and check the community mailbag. I'm really glad to hear back from Brett again, who wrote, great listening to episode 7. I love the surprise of your friend realizing Windows 98 was in color. My CGA monitor was in color as well. I actually destroyed my 8088 motherboard by swapping the P8 and P9 power connectors. Ooh, ouch. I did not care at the time because I had my 386 already. Of course, now it bugs me. I do have memories of True Space 2, that may help with your future Caligari episode. They are not really newsworthy on their own, but maybe it'll help you remember something about your own True Space usage. I use True Space to generate the Star Wars-style 3D text intro to my high school project. That was about the most of it. The most it could do on my 8 megabyte 486 DX475 system without crashing. I remember having frequent crashes when too many objects were on the screen. Me as well, Brett. One of the most interesting things about TrueSpace was how much faster it ran on a Pentium 75 versus a 486-75. The Pentium seemed like a magic CPU in comparison. There was also a rumor somewhere that Terminator 2, the movie, was rendered in TrueSpace, or one of the programs that led to TrueSpace itself. I'm sure that's baloney, but it was a fun rumor at the time. It was probably due to the logo on TrueSpace 2. I don't think filming dates and software dates actually support this. Unrelated to TrueSpace, I was up till 3 in the morning trying to get MS-DOS to boot off an SD card. I have one of those SD to IDE adapters combined with 32 gig SD cards. It's an interesting challenge. My end goal is to run DOS in Windows 3.1 or 3.11 off an SD card instead of a real disk drive. I'm trying the Rufus technique to get it to boot correctly. Thanks for all the good show episodes. I'm looking forward to the next one. Oh, and my YouTube channel, albeit a boring one, is at, and Brett gives the URL, and also gives the URL to his Twitter account. I'll be very happy to post those in the show notes. Brett, thank you so much for writing in. It's great to hear back from you. You're not alone. How many people in the world have cooked a motherboard by accidentally swapping those power connectors? If you're trying to remember, if you're trying to rack your brain remembering what those power connectors looked on an AT motherboard for the P8 and P9 power connectors, unlike the ATX power connector, which is just one solid plug you snap into the board, the old AT-style connectors have two plugs. They're both white, they both look the same as each other, and unfortunately, they both fit into each other's spots perfectly well. At least on most boards that feature that same style of snap-in connector. It's hard to kind of describe on the radio. But basically, the AT connector has a bunch of pinouts that wires run into it from the PSU. And unfortunately, they're meant to go in a specific order. To clarify, I have to repeatedly remind myself when I'm working on any of my 486 boards that the black ground leads on the P8 and P9 power connectors, those black ground leads, they belong together in the center of the connector. If you have it swapped out and you see black wires going into the edges of the power connector, you've got it backwards on the board and you're probably going to cook something and make it go poof. Funny, Brett, regarding TrueSpace on a Pentium versus 486. I actually remember it rendering very quickly on my Pentium 133 at the time. See, I made a huge jump. I went from, I think I've mentioned this in previous episodes, an IBM PS1 486 SX33. And that one, I think we had 8 megs of RAM in it at some point, at least before it died. And then I jumped up to a Pentium 133, and that was a Triton, I think it was called a Triton VX motherboard. VX, I believe. That was an Asus board or something like Asus board. I can't remember who made it, but it did use the Triton chipset. Anyway, I had the opportunity to, like you, both run Caligari TrueSpace on an older 486 and on a new Pentium 133, and holy cow, what a difference. I'm not sure what it had to do with. I'm assuming the Pentium supported some new processor instructions that the 486 didn't support, even though both had floating point units on them. The Pentium definitely had some streamlined ways it worked with the bus, I'm sure. So anyway, really cool that you noticed the same thing as me. Interestingly enough, that Pentium 133 is the same machine I bought when I was 16 years old. I put it together in parts I bought from a local store. I think I had $300 or $400, and I had to build this entire machine for $300 or $400, and I kind of skimped where I could. I think I even managed to buy a board that allowed me to reuse my 72-pin SIMs from the 486 in the Pentium board, if I remember correctly. And I remember that had some sort of performance cost with it, but it meant I saved myself $200 of buying new RAM. Of course, within a few months, 8 megs or 16 megs of RAM that I had in the Pentium 133 wasn't nearly enough. But anyway, thanks for bringing back that memory. I'd sure like to hear an update on your DOS Windows SD card, SD to IDE card project. I'd like to do something similar myself because honestly, those classic hard drives are loud. I've got this Packard Bell 486. I'll talk about this a little bit later on in the show. This Packard Bell 486 has a Seagate, Seagate ST-based drive. It's a 107 meg drive. And at some point, I'll be able to record it. I can't record it now for reasons which will become obvious in a few minutes. Just to know if you guys think it's a loud drive, period, or if this is just a case of poor memory, and I'm forgetting that these boards or these hard drives were loud even back in the day. I think they were quite loud back in the day, but this thing is so loud that it's distracting while I'm working. So I don't know if maybe the bearings are starting to go on it, or if it's just the fact that this is just a 107 meg drive that's over 30 years old and could use a break. So either way, an IDE to SD adapter is very near in my future, not only for my Intel-based machines, but I will also be buying something like that called a SCSI 2 SD for my classic Macintosh Color. Mac Color Classic, I'm sorry. So that's a different story, probably not fitting for this podcast, but I do have this Color Classic that I am restoring at the moment. So again, Brett, great to hear from you. I hope we'll hear from you again, especially with an update on the IDE to SD project. Well, time for updates on my own little projects. Well, remember my old Packard Bell Legend 610? This is the 486 DX4-100 that I've but was using as kind of my daily driver for a long time until it started to kind of undergo this ongoing birth-death cycle over the past year. We last left off with the board booting with corrupted graphics and some battery leakage. I had applied a bunch of vinegar to the board, and as well as some baking soda and everything else I could think of to remove the leakage. I got that cleaned up, and I eventually swapped out the old power supply for a newer ATX power supply with a really handy dandy ATX to AT cable converter. So that basically allows you to take a regular plain old ATX power supply that has both the 12 volt negative and 12 volt positive on it. That's really important for many boards, or at least some of them. and adapt that into an AT power adapter with those pesky P8, P9 pinout on it. It cost me, I think, $5. I bought a couple of them. They turned out to be enormously useful. I was able to not only replace the power PSU on the 486, but I also replaced it on that Pentium 133 that I've had forever. Well, on the Packard Bell, it ran for a few months really well, despite the battery corrosion issue. And then I started to get some really annoying problems. It no longer detected my AW64, that's the Sound Blaster AW64 Gold, properly during boot, and the AW64 kept complaining about corrupted registers in the kind of cards, I won't call it the card's ROM BIOS, but there was some sort of memory corruption with the card itself. So I figured, sadly, that the card was on its way out, and that was a heartbreaker because I don't know if you've checked recently, those classic Sound Blaster cards are incredibly pricey on eBay now. So I was kind of bummed that I was going to lose my favorite sound card. Well, boy, was I wrong. A month ago, I was attending this get-together called the Yearly Adventure Game Studio Awards Ceremony. It's an award ceremony for games developed in this adventure game development engine called AGS, and I was attending. I helped to basically develop the Mac version of the client. It's an online thing, so you can use the game to join into an online ceremony. It's really fun, very unique. Anyway, I was waiting for the ceremony to start, so I thought I'd boot up the old Packard Bell for some fun in Ultima 8. And about a minute into the game, I heard this kind of snap, crackle, pop sound, and a plume of smoke came out of the back of the machine and kind of blew up the wall of my behind my iMac. So I pulled the power cable and I had to put the machine out on the balcony because the smell was so awful. I'm sure many of you are guessing what that smell was. Well, later on that day, I surveyed the damage, and it didn't take me too long, but it took me a while to find the culprit. A capacitor on the ISA riser card blew. If you're unfamiliar, or if you just can't quite remember what a riser card is, the traditional flat motherboard, instead of plugging the ISA cards directly into the board, they had to fit into a more of a lower profile desktop case, a card that literally rose out of the case. It plugged into one slot called the ISA riser slot, and it would allow you to kind of horizontally mount your cards inside the riser card, your ISA cards inside of that, to plug in 3 or 4 or 5 devices. Well, that capacitor blew just below the AW64 Gold, so that said to me, either I've just taken out my beloved AW64, or maybe this capacitor was the cause of all my damn problems with that card. So, in the end, I suspect it was probably a combination of bad caps and a bad PSU causing problems with the AW64. So I went on to eBay, and first I spent some time surveying the damage, trying to figure out what exact capacitors were used on this entire board. It used a lot of them. I counted, I think, in 40 or 50 that I had to replace. This is a lot, keep in mind, for the average motherboard. The average motherboard I looked around had 10 to 15. This had a ton of them. Now, I'm not an electrical engineer. I don't really quite understand the purpose of capacitors other than holding capacitance. But I assume that when you have a lot of them, that's probably, I suspect, due to a little bit of hackery done on the board, or just the fact that they're just trying to cram a lot of components onto a board. This is one of those boards with a lot of built-in onboard controllers, that kind of thing. So that would make a lot of sense. Well, I waited a couple of months. Well, first of all, I ordered 3 types of capacitors, and I bought 100 of each, so I'd have, future-proof myself for future projects. Waited my customary 2 months to get my stuff from China, and it came in finally a few days ago. Well, I started cutting and desoldering the caps on the board, and unfortunately, I found out a different story. Although I thought I was quite careful in counting out the capacitors, unfortunately, there were 5, not 3 types of capacitors on that board. There were 2 of them, I think, were something like 25 volt, 10 I can't remember what the measurement is. Microfarads? I can't remember what it is for capacitors. And I only had, let's say, 50 volts or 16 volt, and I just didn't have the 25. So there were two or three capacitors I couldn't change. That wasn't too big of a deal. None of those ones that I didn't order were blown, so I thought I'd be okay. Well, another bad thing happened. In the middle of replacing 40 to 50 caps, there was a long row of them, four or five caps in a row. I glanced at them, looked at them. They all said something like 16V microfarads or micro something, mu something. And I replaced all of them with the same type of capacitor. Well, just as soon as I finished the fifth one, I looked at the pile of caps that came from that row, and sure enough, one of them was different from the others, and I have no idea which one it was. So, do you ever break something and you start sweating because you don't know how to fix what you just broke? So I had that sweaty, clammy, oh God, what have I done feeling for a minute there. And then I thought, okay, not the end of the world. Maybe I can find a picture of the same motherboard online. Well, unfortunately, no one online had published an exact photo of the same make and model for this Packard Bell motherboard. That was a heartbreaker. So, well, I probably shouldn't have done this, but I booted it anyway. Well, and that was the interesting thing. It wasn't all bad news. It booted. It booted just fine until I set my hard drive parameters and it said hard disk controller failure. That suggests to me that this is very likely one of those caps that I either misreplaced or one of the caps that I couldn't replace has something to do with the onboard hard disk controller. So that means no booting to hard disk. And I thought, I don't want to push this. If I've replaced one cap, if I've swapped one cap with another, I'm not going to stress the board out with a lot of usage. So what do I do now? Well, I went on eBay again, and this is becoming an expensive project. one of my friends, I believe he's a listener of the show. Hi, Andy. Said, oh, give it up. You know, this board is done. Say your goodbyes. And I thought, no, I'm not ready for this. I'm not ready to say goodbye. So I went on eBay, and you wouldn't believe it. Someone was selling the exact make and model of board I had, even down to the same ROM BIOS revision on the board. And on top of that, it also had a brand new riser card and a bunch of peripheral ISA cards plugged into it. So it came with a Sound Blaster Pro 2.0, a new modem, but I'm not sure of the make and model. I couldn't tell. It didn't have any obvious model numbers on it. A CD-ROM drive interface, which I could find really useful for one of my machines that does not have a spare IDE port. And also, this is really cool, the, I don't know what to call it. It's like an onboard modem caddy that plugged into the specific chipset spot on the motherboard. My board didn't have that modem add-on, so the ports were blank at the back of the desktop case. So this is really cool. I ordered the board. It cost me 100 Canadian plus a painful $75 for shipping. But, you know, 175 bucks later, I've got some really cool cards and a motherboard on its way in the mail. So I'm going to keep you updated when that shows up and let you know whether I have any luck. And the coolest thing is, because this is the exact same make and model of the board, I can actually go and check the capacitors in that bank of five that I replaced, misreplaced, and know exactly what belongs where. And this time I'm going to take some photos so I can't lose this. So somebody else reminded me of this, that Packard Bells sure had a reputation for being unreliable in the 1990s. I even remember my friends at work at my old job. I mentioned this in a previous episode. When I was 16, 17 years old, I worked for an ISP that also sold Gateway 2000 machines. Well, my coworkers hated Packard Bell. In fact, they called them packed in hells because of the number of failures that they had from other friends. But you know what? I'd say after 27 years of faithful service, so far, this little guy has been great. All right, how about time for an inventory check? As I mentioned in the last episode, I'm still selling off the bulk of my game collection. And thank you to my friend Ben. I haven't been able to express my appreciation for this. You were very careful in saying, you know what, don't sell them all and keep the stuff you love. I thought that was really good advice, and enjoy the hobby that you love, because it's very tempting to say at some point, I'm past this. I've got other priorities in my life. I want to focus on something else. And yes, that's true for me. I'm a farmer by trade now, so I can't quite spend all my time in games. But on the other hand, I'm also still a video game developer in the winters when I can't be farming. So, I kind of want to keep my feet in both canoes. So thanks, Ben, for being so encouraging. I managed to acquire some other games that I didn't really intend to. There was a great sale. Somebody for $400 was selling 200 games. It was a two-hour drive away, but I drove out there anyway because most of these games were in their boxes and most of them are really cool. So I got another 200 games on top of the 1,000 that I've been trying to sell over the past year. Now, I was able to separate out kind of the junk, known junk in there that I'll, give away to charity at some point. From the good stuff, I kept a good 20 to 25 games for myself, the games I really, really wanted. For instance, the King's Quest and Space Quest Collector's Editions. I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with these. These, I just pulled it off the shelf. I wish I could show you. The Space Quest Collector's Edition, this is the 15th anniversary edition. I'm looking for a date here. I don't see any. 1994. So this is the 94 edition that came in a beautiful cardboard blue box. In terms of what it's got inside the box, it's a little on the chintzy side, but the box itself is so beautiful. I'm just pulling it out here. This is it's in one of those chintzy white cardboard fold-out cases inside of the box. But the box itself is just worth having, and honestly, I am the world's biggest Space Quest fan, aside from Trolls Plimert, the Space Quest historian himself. So I'm very happy to hold a copy of this, us along with that. The first game I ever owned was King's Quest IV. The first game I ever owned for an IBM PC, I should say, was Space Quest IV. So along with that in the collection, I got the King's Quest 15th Anniversary Collector's Edition, which is equally beautiful and in kind of a pinky, dusty rose red tone. Absolutely in love with it. I unashamedly, sorry, Francisco, I know you're listening at some point to this. I do love the King's Quest games. I have no shame for the amount that I do love them, including King's Quest V and your favorite owl friend. So I'm glad to have those. I also got the European versions of the complete Ultima 7 and Ultima 8 and Ultima Underworlds 1 and 2. The European versions, if you're unfamiliar with Origins Ultima series, are different than the North American versions. The North American versions come in very sturdy, kind of hard cardboard boxes with all of the artwork printed directly on the boxes. The European versions come with this slick black, solid black Electronic Arts box that actually, it's kind of generic, but it's very beautiful looking. And then it has a slip cover over top of that that shows the game's name and the screenshots. I've always wanted these because I thought they were attractive in their own right, and I wish that EA had released them in North America. Well, in fact, I even remember passing on a copy that I saw of Ultima 8 in that European slipcase version in a store in 1996, 97. And it was $25, and I thought, I've already caught a copy of Ultima 8. Well, boy, did I regret that. So I was happy to get these finally again. So now that I've got the both European and North American versions, I can honestly say that I do not need another copy of any Ultima game. I also got in the mail a copy of Blackthorn. Blackthorn is this fantastic side-scroller by Blizzard that few people remember. I know Ben and I talked about this through our Discord. And speaking of Discord, I think I should start a Discord for this podcast. If you think that's a good idea, send me an email and I'll send you an invite. I'd be happy to. I was always impressed by the Blackthorn's gameplay and puzzle solving. Even if it was a pretty simple platformer, it reminds me a lot of the game Flashback, The Quest for Identity, and to a lesser extent, Out of This World or Another World. But I always liked Blackthorn, and it has, I'm trying to find the box, the most beautiful box art, very comic bookish. So I was really glad to get a copy of that finally. So all in all, yes, I did buy more games, and I kind of feel a little bit of game shame about buying all of those. On the other hand, I've sold about 150 of my games in the game collection so far, as well as a big chunk of the ones I bought from that big lot of 200 games. I've sold some of those off too, so it's a trade-off, but I'm slowly getting rid of them. So let's get on to our main topic, Ski Free by Chris Pierce. Ski Free was one of the games I ran into at my mother's university computing lab. At the time, I was 12 years old, and my mother was a grad student at the local university. I think my mom kind of got sick of us hanging around her office. I was 12, my sister was 10. So she gave us the key code to the university computing lab, which was on the same floor as her office. Now, keep in mind, we weren't really supposed to be in the lab because this was for students only, but my mom usually dragged us out to the university on weekends or after 5 o'clock, so students weren't really around, and for the few students who were, they didn't care if there were a bunch of kids in the lab. Now, the lab itself was full of, 386 machines. They were all 16 megahertz, so a very low-end 386. But that being said, they were way faster than the 286 we had at home, that being the 286 8 megahertz machine we had. These machines in the lab all ran Windows for Workgroups, that's Windows 3.11, and they all lived on a LAN together that was hooked up via to the internet via a T1 line. It was pretty amazing to be in that place as a 12-year-old, especially I was such a computer nerd by that point. I learned how to use terminal-based email with the Pine client on the VAX VMS server that served the university. I believe it's called the GPU, the General Purpose Unix server, as well as early internet tools like Archie and Gopher, to name a couple. I want to do a whole episode on the origins of TCP/IP networking in Windows 3.1 because if you remember Trumpet Windsock, I think that was a lot of our first experience online was through Trumpet Windsock and possibly Netscape Navigator. And if you didn't make it in there, you will have definitely learned how to use it using dial-up networking or DUN in Windows 95. So anyway, the computer lab computers were pretty boring for my poor sister. She just wasn't into the internet or email, and she wanted to play games, kind of casual type games like Hoyle's Book of Games. Well, it didn't take us long to discover that the university computer administrators, being admins, decided to delete the games folder on the Windows 3.1 desktop. Well, after a bit of digging on the hard drive, we figured out that some students had smartly stashed some games in a secret folder. And of course, one of those games, one of those pieces of software was the Microsoft Entertainment Pack hidden in there too. Well, what is the Microsoft Entertainment Pack? If you can't remember it, it consisted of a few casual games, all programmed by people either inside Microsoft unofficially, unofficially as in this wasn't an official Microsoft project, this was just an on-the-side thing that somebody did, or an actual developer outside of the company, and in one case, for instance, working for Epic Games, I think it was Tim Sweeney. Two of those games you'll probably recognize are Minesweeper and FreeCell. Both of those got their start in the Microsoft Entertainment packs. Well, this lab had Microsoft Entertainment Packs 3 and 4 installed on several of the machines. My sister and I had managed to kind of recon the lab and figure out that of, let's say, 20 desktop workstations there, three of them actually had games on them. And I even went to the length of bringing some low-density diskettes from home so I could copy Ski Free, Rodent's Revenge, and Jazz Ball onto it for our own use at home. The games I best remember from that lab were, as I mentioned, Ski Free, Rodent's Revenge, Jazz Ball, and another one called Chips Challenge. which I think might even be worthy of its own episode at some point. Okay, style. So what kind of game is ski-free? Well, it's an endless runner type game. Now, that genre, that description of games didn't exist 10 years ago, but it does now. So it's a useful way of, you know, kind of describing what ski-free was. In, for instance, Moon Patrol, if you had the old CGA version, or Pitfall, is an endless runner because there are no boundaries to the map. There's no beginning, there's no definite start and end to the map. There's a definite start to the map, but there's no definite end. In fact, both Moon Patrol, Pitfall, and Ski Free have maps that loop at some point. On the other hand, Super Mario 3, for instance, is not an endless runner because there's a definite beginning and end to each level. Now, unlike most endless runners, which scroll horizontally, Ski Free actually scrolls vertically. That's one of the most defining features and makes the game unique to me. You play the role of a downhill skier who tries to make it down the hill at the fastest possible speed, pulling off a few tricks along the way and avoiding as many obstacles as you can before you wipe out. The game has a few different modes. There's a slalom mode where you try to pass flags to the right and to the left of you in sequence down the hill. Slalom would be the event you'd recognize from the Olympics, slalom downhill skiing. It's a timed event, so the idea is the faster you pass the flags, the higher your score, the lower your time. There's also a tree slalom mode where you try to skirt the flags while simultaneously avoiding trees. It's notoriously difficult, for sure. And then finally, this is the mode that I think most people are familiar with. It's the freestyle mode, which mostly consists of pulling off tricks, hitting ski jumps, and avoiding snowboarders and pesky novice skiers. This was usually my favorite mode, just because you could do the silliest stuff in it. Keep in mind, I was 12 years old. So there are some really nice control options in this game. I think what stands out the most to me is the mouse control is excellent. You just move your mouse from right to left. Imagine it kind of like you're swiveling the hips of the skier, and that points you points the skier to the right and the left. You don't have to do anything. The left mouse button performs a jump, and if you're in the middle of a jump, you can click one more time, and your skier is going to do a cute little flip. Now, you can use the keyboard as well. Using the numeric keypad, you can point your skier to the left using 1, point straight down using 2, point to the right using 3. And then the 0 key on the numeric keypad makes the skier jump. And again, you can hit 0 again mid-jump to do a flip. Now, I found that the keyboard controls are not quite as tight as the mouse. For some reason, the mouse feels really, really slick. Again, and you can also, if you really, really want to, use the actual control keys, the arrow keys on your keyboard. So, surprising number of options for a game which is 80 kilobytes. It's tiny. Now, the game itself is definitely a time waster style casual arcade game with, you know, pretty good gameplay. There's something very simple yet tactile about the controls. The skier really does instantly respond to control changes. There's very little way in the way of physics. The skier doesn't slide side to side when they're in the middle of a turn like you'd do in real life. They just kind of instantly turn. There's no vector math or momentum, so that means that the skier kind of turns on a dime the second you move the mouse or hit one of the keys. And for, you know, for most games, this would feel unrealistic or unenjoyable, but for Ski Free, it's perfect. It feels tight. And one final note, you get additional points for style when you're playing in freestyle mode, meaning that if you hit jumps and do midair tricks like turns and flips, or in one case, if you jump over a dead tree, it'll catch fire, you'll get additional points for that too. Now, let's talk nice surprises. Well, the first one that sticks out to me is that it runs fast on old hardware. This is probably a testament to Chris Peary's pretty hardcore graphics implementation, what he did when he was creating the game. The game's extremely responsive compared to anything else I played back in those days. Now, remember, this is 1991-92. Most platformers in those games were pretty sluggish on my 286. I'm thinking of Crystal Caves or Commander Keen. Both ran, you know, well enough on my 286. That was what they were built for. But I noticed their frame rates and their movement were locked at very low speeds, maybe intentionally, because even when I played the game on a 386 and 486, they played pretty much the same. This game, on the other hand, just flies. It ran great on our 286 at home, and even better on the 386s in the lab. Another nice surprise is that the graphics are surprisingly cute. It does not look like your typical Microsoft Entertainment Pack with games that have icons doubling as tiles. I'm thinking of games like Rodan's Revenge, or, I mean, even those games have good graphics, but, you know, they don't look like tiles. You know, it's not going to win an award for best pixel art of the year. It's clearly done in Microsoft Paint. At the same time, all the objects are really easily identifiable and the colors are really fun. So who said programmer art had to be ugly? I actually think of this as some of the most recognizable Windows 3.1 art I've ever seen. I think anybody who saw the kind of stick figure abominable snow monster as a pixel art drawing today would immediately recognize it as coming from Ski Free. So to the developer, Chris Peary, congratulations, you pulled off a look. Another thing I noticed about this was you never feel like you're navigating a tile-based map. The game has some really impressive collision detection that seems to me to be pixel-by-pixel, pixel-based collision detection. I'd like to know more about how the developer pulled that off, but unfortunately I wasn't able to figure that out. I appreciate that there are different game modes. Most games, like the original skiing that this game is based on, I'll get to that later, only have one mode. Well, this has the slalom and freestyle modes, and the tree mode, to be honest, is pretty annoying, but I think there's some people who enjoy it just for your chance to jump over dead trees and start them on fire. The best part of the game for me is its sense of humor. Chris Peary put a lot of love into the offbeat humor. It definitely feels like a personal expression. And the appearances by the abominable snow monster, skiing over dog dew, or I think the dog even pees on the snow and the pee remains on the snow if you hit the dog, or just knocking over other skiers for fun is great. I love the diagonals that the snowboarders ski on. There's something feels really good about the game. And finally, this is cute. I hope this is not a spoiler for anybody, but if you want to see the abominable snow monster in the game and get eaten by him, this happens when you pass the 2,000 meter mark in the game. The abominable snow monster appears on screen and chases you down the hill. It is hilarious. Now, there are some not so nice surprises, as we have with any game. If you aren't 12 years old, you're probably going to tire of Ski Free pretty quickly. This wasn't meant to be a game that you invested dozens of hours into. That being said, many people did put dozens of hours into Ski Free back in the time, back in 1991, just because there were so few other Windows 3.1 games to play. I don't think it has that kind of holding power today. Even playing it recently, I was only really able to enjoy it for 5 or 10 minutes, but keep in mind, I think 5 or 10 minutes was its intended experience. Another not-so-nice surprise was no sound. Oh man, would this game have benefited so much from some goofy sound effects. It makes sense though, the game was built under the table at Microsoft, and loud sound effects in a professional work environment, especially on a person who's supposed to be working on Microsoft Office at the time, probably is a great way of getting canned or demoted or, you know, who knows, have your stapler taken away from you. So I wish, and this is a wish, this is not really a not-so-nice surprise, this is more of a wish. I wish that Chris had released the source code publicly. I think Chris, if you ever hear this podcast, Microsoft kind of officially announced to the a developer that they had relinquished their rights to the Microsoft Entertainment Pack games, so feel free to post this source code somewhere. A lot of us who are interested in Windows 3.1 programming would love to see how you pulled this off. I'd like to know if this was all done via the Windows. You mentioned a couple of abstraction layers. The developer, mentioned a couple of abstraction layers in Windows. I'd like to know what parts were written in C, what parts had to go through the APIs, what parts were even possibly written in assembly. I'd love to know how Chris Peary pulled off such a tiny 80 kilobyte executable. Okay, speaking of which, let's get on to the tech stuff. So the original 16-bit version of the game is packed into a teeny tiny 90 kilobyte executable. That includes the art assets. There are no other files to use in this game other than ski.exe. Very cool. You don't see that happen very often in the Windows world. The game was programmed in C, but I'm not really sure which flavor of C or which C compiler was used to create it. That was something I was hoping I could pull out using some sort of decompiler or possibly just pulling it out in a hex editor. I didn't see anything that stood out as obvious, so unfortunately, I don't think I have the coding chops to pull that off. And I also don't know a lot about decompiling tools, so if you happen to know anything about decompiling EXEs, I'd love to hear from you. All right, on to other tech stuff. The game does actually turn out to possess the sound routines that allow you to play back WAV files, but no WAVs were included in the executable that's distributed online or via diskette. The game actually attempts to load 9 sounds and trigger them at specific points in the game. So that means that, yes, the game does support sound. Unfortunately, there are just no WAV files with it. Here's my suspicion, and I'd love the developer to tell us. I suspect that because this was going to be put in the Microsoft Entertainment Pack, there was probably a floppy disk quota that the developer needed to meet saying, you're only allowed to have 50, 75, 100 kilobytes of space because we have to put 4 or 5 games on this one floppy disk. That's all you're limited to. And the first thing the developer said was, oh, I guess I can cut those WAV files, but they don't really need to belong in the game. And that's how it was lost. So if you know better than me, please let me know. Also hidden in the EXE is the original icon for the game, written hand-drawn by the developer, and it's buried inside of there. You can switch it to the other icon. Let's all be honest, it's not a great icon. It's adorable, cute stick people, but the new icon that was drawn by a graphic artist at Microsoft, and it's really darn good. It's the skier with big goggles holding skis beside them. It's wonderful. Here's another thing that I pulled off of the developer's website. Because there's no guaranteed direct line of communication between the VGA card that'll be installed on your ISA bus and the CPU, this meant doing screen redraws in MS-DOS is extremely slow. Now, this is not due to DOS itself. This is, in fact, due to the physical hardware architecture. Now, at the time, there was something new called Visa Local Bus, and that was becoming a big deal at the time, at least on the computers we got at our house, because Visa Local Bus would allow direct communication between the video card and the CPU, or any card that was using VLB and the CPU. But unfortunately, because that was a kind of a pricey add-on you'd have with your motherboard, that was not guaranteed on every single system. In fact, most people did not have VLB. So how did the developer get around this? Well, the developer came up with a great algorithm to write to video memory very quickly. Today, I'd probably call this a dirty rectangles algorithm. The general idea is that you accumulate a list of rectangular spaces where the screen needs to be redrawn. So, for instance, only places where the screen needs to be redrawn or changed, and only redraw those places instead of redrawing the entire screen at the same time. Or, as Chris puts it himself on his Ski Free website, Ski Free was intended to run on a 386 PC with a VGA display. Such computers were not very powerful, nothing like modern PCs that can do 3D rendering at millions of textured polygons per second. No, in those days there wasn't even any such thing as a video accelerator. The VGA was just a dumb pixel buffer hanging off the excruciatingly slow ISA bus. This made it pretty challenging to get good performance out of the even simple sprite-oriented animation. Windows didn't help matters any by introducing several layers of abstraction between the program and the video hardware. I discovered that it was worth almost any amount of pre-processing on the scare quotes fast 386 CPU to reduce the amount of video I/O over the slow ISA bus. So I designed a fairly clever algorithm to to combine overlapping objects and erasures with and blit minimal regions in each frame. The result was perfectly flicker-free, transparent sprite animation at reasonable speed, even on very slow computers such as an old 286/EGA machine I found in the testing lab. Nowadays, one would probably just render the sprites back to front in a memory buffer and blit the entire window on each frame. Indeed, that is how it is done today. We don't worry so much about refreshes, although, you know, developers to these days still do put a lot of tight hand coding in. It's not into the actual screen redraws. It's more into the poly stuff. So that adds up to some really impressive speed. I can say personally, Ski Free ran fantastic on our 8 megahertz 286 VGA, not EGA, VGA, if you can believe it, a VGA 286 at home as a kid. Now here's the exciting part for me, the development history. In 1991, Chris Peary, and I've been saying Peary, it's possible that it's Peary, but I think it's Peary. I think most people would say that. Please correct me if I'm wrong, Chris. He was working at Microsoft, writing programming tools on the Microsoft Office team, and decided he wanted to get into programming for the new Windows graphical environment that that Microsoft was pushing. This would be probably Windows 3.0 at the time. You know, Microsoft had definitely developed Windows 1.0 and 2.0, but 3.0 was the first time that I think there were serious under the hood changes to allow things for a graphics API. I don't actually know that for sure, but from what I've been reading in interviews, that seems to be the case. So it makes sense that he'd want to learn how to program via its graphics API, if it had any at all. So Ski Free originally began its life on a VAX VMS mini computer at the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, Washington. That's a stone's throw away from Microsoft's HQ, so as you can imagine, on this old VAX VMS mini computer, probably very similar to the computer that I interacted with when I was a kid, it was an ASCII game where you'd avoid little trees with your skier via a dumb terminal. The game itself was inspired by the Atari 2600 or video computer system game Skiing. That was an old Activision game. I played myself it back in the day, and from what I saw of Chris's VAX VMS version, his port of it was very, very similar. To be honest, not the most exciting game I ever played on the Atari 2600. Now, Chris decided that this game would make a great candidate for learning how to program graphics in Windows. Along with some tight graphics code, which I just talked about, the gameplay eventually morphed into the title we recognize today. And eventually, one of the Microsoft managers noticed Chris playing it, testing it, the game at work, one day, and offered to include it in the Microsoft Entertainment Pack number 3. Despite the developer only getting a few dollars for the game, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I'm suspecting it's a few hundred, you know, pocket change, a few hundred bucks. That entertainment pack sold over 500,000 copies. So was Microsoft being chintzy? Yeah, I'd say so. Too bad he didn't get anything more than fame from this. The game was later featured in the Best of Microsoft Entertainment Pack for both Windows 3.1 in 1994 and for the Game Boy Color in, I think, 2000 or 2001. That was news to me. I didn't realize that there was a Game Boy Color version. Now, I haven't tried that, but I am going to look for a copy of it because I'm a huge Game Boy Color fan. I still have my Game Boy Color that I will be retrofitting with a... Is retrofitting the right word? I think it is. That I will be refitting with a backlit screen so I can play backlit GBC games on it. Now, back to our story. After losing the source code for several years, Chris rediscovered it in 2005 and recoded parts of it as a 32-bit app. That means if you have a version of Windows that does support 32-bit applications, you can actually play it on there. I have not tried playing Ski Free on Windows 32-bit. I've only played the 16-bit version because I run 16-bit Windows 3.1 in DOSBox, like many of you. So I don't really know what happens when you try to run it on, say, Windows 10. I suspect newer versions of Windows 10 that do not support 32-bit operations will probably just choke on and say, sorry, can't play it. So that either says to me, maybe the author is going to reintroduce it as a 64-bit app, or maybe, like everyone else, we'll just have to run it in DOSBox. Now, where to get the game? Chris Peary released both the 16-bit and 32-bit versions of his game on his own website, the Most Officialist Ski-Free Homepage. This website is so lovably 1996-ish that I'll link to it in the show notes so you can download your own copy of it. It's a great website. I wouldn't even call it a website. It is a homepage. It is most definitely a homepage and reads like one. If you're old enough to know the distinction between a web page and a homepage. There is an iOS port of the game by a company called Gearsprout, but I noticed that the gameplay has changed enough to not really make it worth playing. The controls have gotten softer. It's missing some of the charm of the original game. I just didn't really feel like this played like Ski Free, at least not the Ski Free I grew up with. Maybe it's a good port on its own, but it's not for me. Should I release my own Ski Free port that plays identically to the original? That is very, very tempting. Maybe I'll even just make it completely free on the App Store. So if you have any ideas on that, let me know. I would love to just do it as a fun side project. Finally, this is great. Thanks to the developer, you can buy an Abominable Snow Monster t-shirt from Cafe Press. And yes, the Cafe Press that existed from 20 years ago is still around. And the proceeds do go to Chris. I think you know what's on next year's Christmas list for me. So thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Multimedia Hyperguide. I don't know when I'll be coming back to you next. That kind of depends on how my farming season goes and how much free time I have. Generally, just to let you in on the loop of why I can't publish these every single week, it used to be that my wife had every Saturday at work, so that kind of meant I had the whole apartment to myself on Saturdays to record this, because it has to be quite quiet in here to record the episode. Very fortunately for us, she's had Saturdays off for the last few months, so I just haven't been able to see you at all. She worked today, which is why I'm recording, and possibly will be pulling a few Saturdays in the future. So if and when those opportunities come up, I will put out an episode. Don't worry, folks, I'm not going away. This show will not experience pod fade. It will just be experiencing pod turning down for a little while and then coming back. I do fully intend to exhaust as much of the Windows 3.1 world as I can with episodes. It just means it's going to take a few years. I'm still young. I haven't even turned 40 yet. Well, pretty soon, actually. But I think I've got a good 20 years left in me to figure out Windows 3.1 episodes. So here's another invitation. If you'd like to be on the episode and chat with me about Windows 3.1 stuff, I'd love to hear from you. I actually don't enjoy hearing my own voice for an hour at a time. So if you've got an episode idea, or if you just want to chat Windows, DOS, Intel-based stuff for a few minutes, I'd love to hear from you. Write to me, VGA@VGA256.com. That's VGA@VGA256.com. All right, this is Super VGA signing off. I'm looking forward to seeing you.